Welcome to the Faithful and True podcast. Today, Greg, we have been asked by many of our listeners to what would it take for us to feature some of our legacy podcasts. And by that, I mean going back to the days when Mark and I started with the Men of Valor program. We didn't know what a podcast was back in those days, but we knew that Mark had a lifelong dream of having a radio show or an online radio show, didn't quite understand what a podcast might mean to us. So we started with the Men of Valor program, and things just kind of grew from there. Mm-hmm. So today we'd like to feature one of those legacy podcasts from the Men of Valor program.
Yeah, we're going back into the archives, and this is something that I've heard Mark and Debbie talk about for years. And so the one we're going to be featuring today is Mark and you talking about the 14 things that a husband can do to begin to rebuild trust after there's been betrayal. And in full disclosure, I think Deb is the one who came up with the list.
Yes.
And then Mark shared that with the men that were listening at that point.
As we both know, Mark was capable of talking on any on any subject matter. In fact, back in those days, the pre-program prep was sometimes very brief.
Right.
As in, what do you want to talk about today?
Yeah.
So I'm excited for us to launch these legacy podcasts because I want our listeners to gain the appreciation I know you're going to gain by being exposed to the teachings of Mark Lazer.
Yeah. One other thing I would add before we begin to listen to it is, you know, I mentioned the fact that Deb is the one who probably came up with the list. And I think that that's significant because it wasn't just Mark thinking about what should men do in order to rebuild trust. This information comes from all of the work that Deb did in her own journey, as well as the years of experience that she has working with women as she began to hear and understand these are valuable things that a man can do so that he can begin to rebuild trust with his wife after there's been betrayal.
In fact, that list began with Debbie calling it the things that Mark did mm-hmm. to rebuild my trust. So Mark and Debbie had the unique position of not only having their own successful healing journey, but then the hundreds, if not thousands, of individuals that they have helped, as Mark helping the husbands, Deb helping those mm-hmm. wives, and together the number of couples that they showed that their marriage could not only survive, but could thrive.
Mm-hmm.
And these points that you'll hear today are among those things that that you can do to help your relationship.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
So, with that in mind, we'd like to play for you this legacy podcast on rebuilding trust.
Okay, we'll start into this. So again, the topic is for all of you husbands who would like to consider the idea that you are rebuilding trust with your wife after discovery of the fact that you've betrayed that trust. So, and these points I think they're actually in somewhat of an order, but not necessarily. So, you know, don't take it necessarily as number one is the most important. But on the other hand, as I look at it, I think number one might be the most important.
And well, point one, as you point that out, is he, meaning the husband, he is willing to get help to accept that he has a problem.
Yeah, now that can mean a lot of different things, but I do know that that's key. I mean, how long have the husbands been hiding, been telling lies, been living in secret, the double life, and how long have they been making excuses and so forth? So, you know, whether they get discovered by their wife or others or whether they self-disclose, we're talking here now, I think, about an attitude of humility. They are willing to get help. They know that they can't figure this out on their own. So, in other words, historically, they may have said to themselves, I could stop this when I want to. If I need to get help, maybe later down the road I will. But in the meantime, I think I can handle this. So, you know, this is an admission of your own brokenness, your own humility. It's the fact that you do, in fact, need help. And sometimes I refer to this one as brokenness. We talked about that in the Nehemiah principles. Principle number one, you know, you're sad, you're broken, you're humble, you're repentant, you're willing to get whatever help it takes to get free of the problem.
And Mark, isn't it true that we oftentimes, or occasionally, I don't know how often, I know that we deal with those times that the wife will call us and the husband is not admitting to having a problem. He's downplaying it, right, or he just hasn't come to grips with the reality that he indeed does have this problem.
Yeah, and there's something in here about a willingness to get help. So in other words, he may, at some lip service level, say, yeah, I think I do have a problem. But you remember the point started with he is willing to get help. So we've seen that happen a lot of times where, you know, the wife comes in and she's just discovered something, or he's been found out, or he's self-confessed. And she is obviously dealing with a lot of pain. And the husband may, you know, acknowledge the fact, particularly if he's self-confessed, that he has a problem. But it's, you know, it's more than that. It's his willingness to get some help. So, you know, that's going to speak much more loudly to the wife, that he's willing to do that.
And that just kind of leads to his dedication to her and his willingness and desire to keep the marriage going.
That's right.
Because so oftentimes these men who have been struggling with sexual purity issues, it too often leads to infidelity, and that infidelity leads to, you know, more serious problems. And they really do, in most cases, want to keep see what they can do to repair and heal the marriage.
Well, I think it's number two kind of gets at this, that it's not just that they're willing to get help or they're humble about this, but it's like the way Debbie writes it here is he is broken and remorseful. He has a changed heart. He wants to get well, which is the first spiritual question that we've always talked about, and that is, this is not about pacifying his wife now. This is not about placating. This is not about being codependent. This is not doing it because if he doesn't do it, he's going to wind up divorced. This is a changed heart. This means that from the center of his soul, you know, he is willing to get well for himself. And one of the ways we always put this is, even if you don't wind up staying married, we'd still like that attitude to be present in you, that you have a changed heart, that you want to be sober for yourself. We had a situation yesterday where, it takes too long to describe, but the wife had just, you know, more or less had it with a variety of different factors and announced to us that she was going to be divorced and had, you know, talked to a lawyer and was going to file papers. We never like hearing that, although at times we accept it, particularly if, you know, number one and number two are not in place. But the husband, at some point during the session, said, you know, I just need you to know that I still love you, and I am going to stay sober for me and also my role as father to our children. And I thought that was a humble heart
yes.
at that point.
Yeah, and that's proving your point right there in point two. He is broken and remorseful, and he wants to get well.
Well, there's other things to motivate us, too. It's not just staying married. It's also, you know, wanting to break the cycle of addiction. It's, you know, the cycle of addiction, which affects the sins of the father being passed down to the next generation. He wants to be sober for his children. And I think the great thing he did, which was an indication of this, is that he didn't try to argue her out of it. I think historically that had been part of the problem. He had used way too many words, and it just drowned her out with defensiveness. So, you know, part of this changed heart is, you know, not being defensive.
Can we share point number three here? Okay, so point number three is he's willing to do whatever it takes to stay sober and to change his life. Many men for accountability, counseling, working on trauma, etc.
Yeah, I think I think the listeners can hear how all of these points are related. So in other words, if you are willing to get help, if you are broken and humble, if you have a changed heart, then you will do whatever it takes to stay sober. And it does mean, you know, going to at least a group and having men in your life with whom you're accountable. It may also mean, if you have significant emotional and spiritual issues, going to Christian counseling. It may also mean that if you've had trauma in your early life, you're willing to face into that. It's amazing to me how many men there are that just look at some of that early life stuff and say, it's way too painful, I just don't want to look at it. And it does take a lot of courage to do so. So those are all indications that he's willing to do whatever it takes, however much time, however much money, and however much effort it takes to get to some of these things. I mean, we have men driving here for a group that come from 3 or 4 hours away. So, you know, those are the guys that Alcoholics Anonymous says that are willing to go to any length you know, to get the help that they need.
Yeah, it takes a real effort to overcome the miles and the scheduling conflicts that can produce. So Mark, moving on, point four says he works diligently on setting boundaries for himself.
Yeah, that's right. So we have done shows on, you know, the accountability program that we use and suggest. Part of that is developing this concept called the three circles, the inner circle being all the behaviors the addict is going to stop. The middle circle, sometimes referred to as the yellow circle, involves all of the rituals and the triggers and the vulnerabilities that addicts can get into, which will lead them into the inner circle or the red circle, the things they need to stop. So we're kind of, for those listening who are familiar with that, we're kind of right smack dab in the middle of the middle circle or the yellow circle. And the guy who's going to be successful is setting up lots and lots of boundaries around any and all of his ritual behaviors. For example, today at lunch, Debbie was talking about a wife who recently came in whose husband has really not been that involved with us. And one of the things she was saying is that her husband was interviewing somebody for his job or something like that, but it involved taking an attractive young woman out to lunch. Now, you know, this is a guy that has had problems with acting out in the past. Part of his ritual may have been to, you know, have lunch with attractive women, have coffee with attractive women, talk to attractive women at work. I don't know. But the guy that's going to avoid having affairs or sexual encounters with other women is not going to do anything in private with any women, you know, and that's got to be a part of his ongoing program. So, you know, there can be lots of other things in terms of, you know, what you watch, what you don't watch, where you go, where you don't go, that kind of thing. We talked a lot on the show about boundaries, but I think the key point here is that the addict or the husband here is establishing these boundaries for himself, because if he doesn't do it, I think here's an important point that Debbie would emphasize, and that is if he doesn't do it, it's going to be very tempting to do it for him. And this is where wives get involved, kind of as we say here, jumping in his hoop, suggesting things, and maybe sometimes not always in the most kind of ways, but do you think you should be watching that? Do you think you should be going there? Do you think you should be having lunch with that woman? That kind of thing. So the point here, I think, for the men is the more proactive they get about defining and practicing their own boundaries, the less likely it will be that their wives are going to have to do it for them, and their wives can relax and have a sense of peace. Remember, we're talking here about rebuilding trust. That's the theme of our show today. So one of the main things to do is to make sure proactively you're letting your wife know all of the boundaries that you are following, all the things you are not going to do, and all the healthy things you are going to do.
Point number five here is also very powerful, I think, and that is the husband does not blame the wife for his choices or for his acting out.
Yeah, and that's obviously critical. That could go up, you know, farther toward the first thing or the first point. But I think historically, a lot of the addicts blame a lot of things for their acting out. And it certainly can be true that they've blamed their wives for, you know, this or that, or being angry or not being frequent enough with sexuality, or whatever else it is. So whether they have any anger at their wife historically or not is not the point. If they're going to build trust, they're going to have to stop blaming her for any of their behaviors. And this is, again, going back to points one, two, and three, you're taking responsibility for your own behavior.
The next point on point six is he shows patience for the wife's questions or dealing with her anger or addressing her hurt, her pain.
Yeah, when I think of this one, I always think of the truth kind of anthropologically that men are fixers. They have a fix-it nature inside them. Women do too, I think. I mean, I think this is a gender stereotype that we have that's not always accurate. But I do know that it's oftentimes the case that the addict, having been the offender, the one who's betrayed trust, you know, he would like it to be fixed pretty fast. So he would like to do whatever he can to get his wife to trust him again. But his sense of timing of that is probably 1 or 2 weeks, where, you know, our sense of timing of that may be 1 or 2 years. So there's a disconnect there someplace, and I often run into it. And I was talking to a husband not too long ago who I was telling this dynamic to, and he basically said to me, "I love you, Mark, but," and then he insert
a large but.
A large, no. He inserted a large word that starts with the letter F. But anyway, he was just really angry about, you know, the fact that I was suggesting to him that he was not being patient. So this point requires patience, and it's a willingness to answer the wife's questions, to allow her to be angry and hurt without trying to talk her out of it. Now, the questions part, I know that there's a fine line here at certain points where, you know, the wives may be asking the same question over and over again, like 100 different times. And if that's the case, then we are going to encourage the wives to say, if you're asking a question 100 times and you're getting an answer to that question, but it doesn't seem to satisfy you, it may be that there's some other question behind that question, or there's some other perception in the question. But for the purposes of today's show, we're talking about the fact that the husband needs to be willing to answer questions, and he needs to be willing to do that for however long it takes. Something could come up, and I know it has for Debbie and I, you know, 20 years down the road, you know, tell me a little bit more about this or that, and I have to be willing to answer whatever questions come up, however long that takes.
And is that mainly due to the fact that the wife isn't liking the answer that he's giving to whatever that question is?
Well, it could be that she doesn't believe the answer. That's a possibility. Whether she likes it or not, I oftentimes think that when the wives are asking a lot of their questions, they're really asking the why question. You know, like, why did you do this? And that's a question that I think the husbands can eventually answer. But in the early days particularly, they don't have a clear sense of that. So they keep asking, how could you have done it 5 times, not 4 times? How could you have gone there? How could you have been with that woman? How could you have gone to that site, or whatever it is? And I think in many ways they're wanting to know, how could you have done this to me?
Are most of the husbands successful in coming up with an acceptable answer for that?
Yeah, I think it goes back to our earlier points. If they're doing the counseling, they're looking at their early life trauma, they're taking their neurochemistry seriously, they can generally find out when sexual arousal became something they associated with managing their emotions. And that's one of our main teachings about the why question. It's like the addicts have all learned that sexuality, or the neurochemistry that sexuality produces, is one of the ways they manage their emotions. So I think they all learn after a while. And then there's always a story behind that association. And I think if they're willing to tell the stories of their early life, then the wife can begin to understand how this whole thing developed in the first place. And most importantly, that it way preceded her, you know, in terms of
when it's history with
him. It's history with him.
Right.
Yeah, right.
Now, is that commonplace? You mentioned a moment ago that suddenly out of nowhere, years down the road, a question arises again.
It may, yeah.
Yeah. Is that fairly common?
Well, sure, it could be. I know we have one couple now that we're working with where the husband did do a lot of acting out in parks and hotels. And, you know, now a year or two later, is there driving places? She still has questions about, did you act out there? Did you act out there? That's an important question, because if you're driving by places or you're going in hotels, the wife can sometimes sense that there's a certain energy here, or the wife or the husband is uncomfortable with something. And I think it's completely legitimate at that point to ask, is this a place where, you know, you acted out?
And I would think that the husband would want to do all he can to not trigger the wife. You know, but I mean, trying to be forthcoming, of course, but at the same time, you know, if it gets to the point that now she's doubting every place they drive past.
Right. Well, you know, I think, you know, one of the things we're going to try to teach our couples is how to have safe conversations when they are triggered. So, you know, we're going to hope that we never completely avoid triggers. And what we can learn is how to talk about them with each other in safe and healthy ways.
When they do happen, right?
Yeah, right.
First of all, we're going to want to thank Debbie for contributing this list to us. But our last point today is going to be, the husband supports the wife's need to get help, whether that be the money that will be necessary or the extra effort in helping with their kids.
Well, those are two things. But the idea that the husband is willing to financially, or in terms of childcare, or whatever else he needs to do, you know, taking time off work to watch the children, working an extra job to earn money, he does whatever he needs to do. I mean, we've always looked at the financial resources of a couple and said that it needs to be distributed three ways. A third of it for the husband and the help he gets, a third for the wife and the help she gets, and then a third of it for their couples counseling. And some of the husbands historically have controlled the checkbook, the bank accounts, you know, and all the money. A lot of times the wives come in here and they are unaware, in fact, of how much money they as a couple actually have. I mean, I'm surprised by that. I mean, as we all know, you and I know, Debbie is incredibly competent when it comes to handling financial matters. So I've never had the thought, number one, that Debbie didn't know about any of this stuff. But there are a lot of wives out there for whom that is true. And the husband, I think, in his humility, his brokenness, his change of heart, I think he needs to let her know. I think he needs to start including her in that. And he needs to tell her, yes, we have enough money for you to go to counseling. Or we have insurance, or we have whatever it takes. I will do whatever it takes to watch the kids to make sure you can get to your group or go to your counseling session, you know, that kind of thing. Well, I think it's one of our most frequently asked questions as to whether or not the wife can ever trust the husband again. And I would love for our listeners to know that, yes, that can certainly take place. It may take longer than you'd like for it to take, but certainly it does happen. Debbie, I've heard her say 100 or more times in public speeches that she completely trusts me today and, in fact, doesn't even think about it that much anymore if it weren't for the fact that we're doing speeches and writing books about it.
Exactly. Launched a career on, yeah. on that. Right. Well, thanks for that great knowledge and wisdom there, Mark. Number 8 on this rebuilding trust list is... He doesn't let my behavior, opinions, or feelings distract him from staying sober, demonstrating internal motivation.
Well, yeah, it's sometimes hard just to read the bullet point there. But basically what I think this means is that the wives' reactions, particularly during the first year, are going to be a roller coaster. That's how we describe it. We sometimes say it's like a slinky. You know, they have a beginning when there's first discovery and maybe an end when there's, total trust rebuilt and peace. But in the meantime, there can be highs and lows, and there can be anger outbursts, and there can be lots of tears, and there can be, lots of pretty dramatic behavior. So what we're saying here, or what Debbie is saying, that it helps the wife build trust. If the husband can kind of sit on his internal fixer and not try to fix the wife, not try to argue her out of her feelings, not try to fix her feelings, not try to placate the feelings, just let her have them and listen to them as best you can. And sometimes that does take a lot of patience, which is a character quality that a lot of the men, at least in the early days, don't have a lot of.
And yet in the end, this really is proving his determination and, as it says here, his internal motivation on his healing journey.
Well, the internal motivation part means that rather than the motivation being based just on how his wife is reacting and whether or not she stays or leaves or that kind of thing. In other words, he's not just basing his motivation on the fear of consequences. He's saying, I'm going to stay sober no matter what. The sobriety that I seek is for my benefit, regardless of the reactions or the effect it has on my wife. So I will say that that takes a while to get to. It's not something that just comes overnight, but that is obviously, as men, one of the goals we seek. So whenever I think about this one, I remember at the very first counseling center that Debbie and I went to, it was a mom-and-pop type drug and alcohol treatment center that was also accepting those of us with sexual addiction. And we had, just like we do here at Faithful and True, we had in the evening groups for men and groups for women. And this little counseling center was kind of one of those metal buildings that wasn't all that soundproof. And the men would meet on one side of it, and the women would meet on the other side of it. And the wall in between was not that thick. And it's not so much that we could hear the conversations, unless, of course, the wives were doing some anger work. And the therapist there actually would have them beat up pillows and
punching bag
therapy, chairs,
right?
Yeah. And there was often yelling and screaming, and so the men who were sitting there trying to have group would fairly often hear this screaming going on. We were never quite sure which one of us was being worked on, but we would sometimes take bets and find out later.
It felt like the whole group was taking a beating sometimes.
Yeah, sometimes it did, but so anyway, it was good for me in those early days to actually be in a group where you could talk about how difficult it was sometimes to listen to all the pain that your behavior had created. So anyway, number 8, we could talk about it a lot longer, but it's that patient ability to be a good listener and not try to talk your wife out of her feelings.
Number 9 then, Mark, is the husband is willing to regularly offer information about being sober.
Yeah, being proactive. One of the things I've always said is that I always considered a given day a failure if I hadn't told Deb that I was sober that day, as opposed to her having to ask me. So I think it builds trust because the men have historically been liars and deceivers, and they haven't been honest about these things. So if we're going to build trust, we have to demonstrate that we're changing, we're offering information, not hiding information. We're not waiting to be asked, we're being proactive about it. So I would regularly check in with her on a given day that today was a sober day until I finally got to the point where she actually told me I don't need to hear it every day. Then it was once a week for a while, then it was once a month, and now I think she's at the point that she doesn't need to hear about it necessarily. She just kind of assumes it's in place unless she could tell if I wasn't sober. I will tell you that. I mean, I would obviously look despondent and despairing if for some reason after all this time I had had a slip.
Well, speaking of all this time, I would be remiss if I did not mention, because we made a passing reference to it, I think, a week or two ago, that this coming weekend, this Friday, I believe, mm-hmm. is the 30th anniversary of your recovery, of your sobriety. That's 30 right. years of recovery and sobriety.
That is St. Patrick's Day. And I'm half Irish, and that is the day that, I went into treatment in 1987, and here we are, March 17th, 2017. And it doesn't seem like that long ago, but it was 30 years ago. And that's what we say, you know, one day at a time. All of a sudden, here I am at 30 years.
Well, we want to commend you on that because it's something that you deserve to be very proud of, and I know you are. You know, this last principle that we mentioned, that number 9, being willing to regularly offer information about being sober, it reminds me of the principle that you and Debbie teach, I believe usually with the couples, and you, it's I think, basically a brainchild of yours and Debbie's, and it's referred to as Phanos.
Phanos is one of the vehicles that we have used over the years. It's an acronym for feelings and other things check-in, and it takes 5 minutes. I think we have this on our website, do we not?
Yes, we do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, okay. So if you're interested in getting the full explanation, but Phanos stands for I'm going to tell Debbie my feelings. I'm going to give her an affirmation. That's an A. I'm going to state a need to her, not necessarily of her, but a need that I have. I'm going to own something that given day. And then the S is I'm going to check in about whether I'm sober that day. So that's Phanos. And the wife similarly checks in and figures out something for the S for herself. You know, usually they talk about spiritual growth, or maybe they're dealing with something that they wanted to stop and they can check in on that. But this should be succinct. It should take 5 minutes. And
it's an effective exercise.
Yeah. A lot of the couples find that it's one of the more helpful things they do, and it's one of the simplest things. Where they can sometimes get in trouble is if they don't abide by the rules, and that it's only supposed to be a check-in. If you use the word because in your check-in, you're probably going to get lost in a much longer conversation.
Well, let's take number 10 on this list. Number 10 says that the husband is willing to be honest about all things, where he's going, who he's with, why he's late, etc.
Yeah, so in other words, in my old lecture about building trust, the 7 C's, because every point began with a C, I call this one consistent, and it basically means that chances are that, you know, the addict was not just lying about his sexual behaviors. He was lying about where he was, what he was doing, who he was with, why he was home late or not. And so building trust is about being honest in everything you do. One of the oldest examples that we think of is if you say you're going to be home for dinner at 5:30, be home for dinner at 5:30. If you can't be home because something has come up, then make sure you call or text, I guess, these days, and let your wife know that you've had something come up at the office or wherever, and you're going to be X amount of time late. So if you say you're going to take the kids to do something, do it. In other words, whatever you're committed to do, whatever you say you're going to do, whatever you say you're not going to do, be consistent in not doing or doing those things.
Well, in other words, what you're really doing is you're encouraging our husbands out there, our male listeners, to be an open book.
That's right. And, you know, in the early days, Debbie had access to my phone. I guess I'm trying to remember what that was like because we didn't have cell phones back in the early days of my recovery. We didn't have emails. I know what it was. He had access to open any mail coming into
me. Oh, I see. So there was no secrets there if something came in the mail, right?
And I encouraged her to look at the monthly phone bill to make sure that I wasn't making any inappropriate calls. If there was a number on there that she couldn't figure out who or what it was, I would tell her. Or just tell her to call it.
Sure,
to make sure she knew what it was.
Boy, how times have changed. Times really, and technology have changed, Mark.
Yeah, it's really something.
Point 11, Mark, is the husband is willing to talk about the past as the wife needs him to. And in other words, providing full disclosure.
Well, we already talked about full disclosure. That was one of the earlier points. What this is referring to is that after there has been full disclosure, if the wife needs to talk about any of that that she's learned or discovered, that she has the freedom to ask questions about this. And the wife, when she does it, the husband is willing to answer those questions. And she may have, you know, 10 years down the road, I mean, she may have something that comes up, something that triggers her, something that runs across her awareness, and it may spark a question in her, and we're willing to answer whatever questions they have. The most famous story that I tell about this, I don't know if it's famous or not, but I'm the kind of extemporaneous speaker where I can be in the middle of a speech and something comes to me, and I'm not always sure where it comes from. I hope sometimes it comes through the inspiration of the Holy Spirit, but I was giving a speech over in Wisconsin someplace, I think, and it was being recorded. And I was in the middle of telling my story, and something that I had done that wasn't all that egregious, but it was something that I had done, and I hadn't remembered it before. I hadn't remembered this detail of it, and I just kind of spontaneously said the detail. And Debbie, oftentimes when she's on road trips, and back in those days she was quite a lot, she would listen to some of the cassette tapes of my speeches. She heard this one particular cassette, and she heard this detail, which was something that I hadn't shared with her before. So she got off the road and called me and said, I just heard this tape. And I said, oh, yes, that is true. I'd completely forgotten about it. But there was this detail that came up in the middle of the speech, and I said it. And obviously it was recorded. And is there anything else you need to know about that? And she said, no, I just kind of found it interesting. Isn't memory an interesting thing? So at that point, she was a number of years down the road.
Sure, so a lot more secure in in the healing journey and that process.
Yeah, but we could be talking about a lot of stuff that's happening in the first year for sure.
Right.
This one.
Well, the 12th point, Mark, on this list is that the husband establishes many boundaries for himself so as to resist temptation and triggers or rituals that would lead to him acting out.
Well, basically that means that the husband is going to do what he can to share the program, so to speak, that he's working on. We've talked a number of times on this show about the three-circle plan, and the middle circle of that is all about the yellow circle getting into the your rituals, your triggers, and so forth. And we find that it's one thing to tell a wife that you're sober, which means you're saying that there are certain behaviors that you've defined as sobriety that you are not doing. But what we find is it's helpful to create trust when you're also reporting on the positive behaviors that you're doing, the boundaries you're putting in place so that you don't get into the inner circle, the acting out circle. And also we find it helpful for the husband to be sharing the self-care that he's doing. So, for example, this happens all the time. Guys come to the counseling group, and the wives have to ask them, what did you talk about at group tonight? Or, you know, what did you learn tonight? I think it's better and it builds more trust if the husband comes home and says, this is what I talked about tonight. This is what I learned tonight. These are the awarenesses I had tonight. Now, if for some reason he comes home and he's exhausted or the kids are in the way or whatever, then I, you know, if it were me, I might say, look, I'd love to share with you everything that happened in group tonight. Let's get the kids in bed, or let's talk at breakfast in the morning when we do our devotionals, or whatever it is. But rather than waiting for the wife to ask for these details about the plan that I'm working, offer up that
information.
Be proactive.
Right, okay. Well, point 13 of our rebuilding trust list is the husband is willing to maintain additional boundaries that would help the wife feel safe.
Yeah, this is kind of a fine line because we also teach the men that they cannot manage their wife's anxieties, and that, you know, she has some responsibilities for working her own plan and program around that, going to her groups, calling her accountability partners. But what this means is that there may be certain things that the husband may not think are all that important. He may not feel all that triggered by, but the wife is triggered by them. So if I'm willing to serve and make amends, it's a boundary that I would be willing to observe.
So that's being especially sensitive or alert to what her triggers are, right? Is that what I'm hearing?
Well, yeah, not all of her triggers, but her triggers around things that she sees that I'm doing or not doing that might cause her some anxiety. I think this is an important one, particularly in the first 6 months or so. Mm-hmm. But it basically means that the wife says, when I see you watching that, it causes me a great deal of concern. The husband may decide, even though that particular program may not be a huge trigger to him, he will abstain from doing that if it serves her.
Sure. Well, Mark, this collection of important points on rebuilding trust comes to the conclusion with point 14, which says the husband is working on understanding the why of his addictive behaviors, mm-hmm. the deepest root causes.
Yeah, I think that's the main question that the wives have. I mean, that's a large question. It's like, why did you do this? How could you do this? How could you do this to me? I think this shows up in a lot of other forms. Sometimes the wives want to describe some behaviors that the husband is doing. And basically behind the question is always the why question. You know, why are you doing this? And so what this says is that it's one thing for the husband to stop all the sinful behaviors. It's another thing to understand how they got into them in the first place. So,
well, I think it's one of the leading questions that are on the mind of the guys. Tomorrow morning, we're going to welcome 30-plus men coming to us from across the country for the Men of Valor 3-day intensive workshop.
Right.
And I can tell you from talking to so many of them as they call or call to register or have questions about the workshop, mm-hmm. That's weighing heavily on their mind. I want to get at why do I do these things?
That's right. And so I'm, you know, it's interesting as you said that. I think that a lot of the men come and they just want to learn how to stop. And but we're going to hammer them and help them and hopefully facilitate talking to them about their history through some exercises. And we hope that they leave the workshop with some understanding of the why. I know that I address it a number of different times in terms of how to make the associations back in their history. So yes, that is one of the primary goals of the workshop, is to help the husband understand the why. And in terms of the wife and building trust, I think it's important for them to know that the why is not about them. In other words, it's not because they did this or didn't do that. It's the addiction is brought into the marriage, and the beginning of it started at a much earlier point, which means that the husband is going to have to be willing to do some of this deeper work.
Well, then, Mark, wrap up these 14 points for our listeners and you know, give us that ray of hope as we have tried to digest these 14 points in rebuilding trust.
Well, I think one of the things that men are going to have to be aware of that might be listening to this, particularly if they're in the early days of their recovery, is that this whole thing involves a great deal of patience, and it involves a great deal of love and understanding of your wife. And in the early days of your recovery, you might not be seeing behaviors on her part that, you know, would inspire you to, you know, want to serve that, or you've got some age-old anger. And my recommendation is that if you're angry at your wife and don't feel like doing any of this kind of stuff, that you definitely get some help for that. Talk to your group, talk to your counselors, take it to the Lord in prayer. But this is a way, these 14 things are the ways that we serve. And I think more importantly, it's a way that we make amends for all the stuff we've done.
Well, Greg, as we had promised, that I'm sure that the listeners have gathered great direction and great guidance from the words that Mark shared with us on that podcast.
Mm-hmm. So listen, in the future, we're going to be sharing kind of the part two of that particular podcast. And in that podcast, Deb joins Mark,
right,
to talk about this idea of rebuilding trust and what it looks like for a couple. Because we know that for couples where there has been betrayal, this issue of rebuilding trust at first is a mystery. It's even a question of whether or not it's possible. And Mark and Deb do a great job of inviting couples to this journey of rebuilding trust. So
absolutely,
join us again.
Great. Thank you for joining us on this Legacy podcast. And we look forward to bringing you more Legacy content in the months and weeks to come.